Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
You are listening to Missed Apex Podcast. We live F1. Welcome to Missed Apex Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Spanners Reddy. This is a news show this week, so we do have a panel joining us. But we also stumbled into an awesome 15-minute interview. We had the opportunity that I don't think a lot of independently owned podcasts get. I was pretty surprised to be invited to talk to someone at director level, a personality you will have heard of, within the F1 organization. So I guess when the FIA want to talk about a new feature or push a new aspect of the show, of the broadcast, they line up the journalists in like a press junket. So maybe they go online and they invite the likes of Joe Saywood and Chris Medland and ESPN, all those kind of things. And then they talk to the representative for a bit, ask the questions they want, and then they get to write it up. I think generally podcasts aren't really part of that. But for this latest innovation, I was surprised and delighted that Missed Apex was invited to come and join that junket. It's a surprise because podcasts don't normally do that kind of thing. I confirmed, I said yes before they could change their mind. And I could tell it wasn't quite inside what they normally do because the representative was quite surprised. He went, what? Am I going to be on a podcast now? We're recording it now? I went, yeah, is that all right? And you could see the kind of, oh no, I wasn't prepared to be on a podcast, but he just switched and went, that was it. Yep, I'm in. And then dropped in and joined us for an interview. So that was pretty exciting. And I asked afterwards, I said, how come we've been included in something like that? Like, I really wasn't expecting anything like that. And the representative just said, right, well, we looked at your reach. You know, this is a booking agent. We looked at your reach and saw value in what you were doing. So we invited you along. And that now has to be credited to every single person out there who's ever shared a link, who's ever told their friends, go and check out Missed Apex Podcast, because we don't have a big advertising budget. You are the biggest tool we have, and you've deployed yourselves fantastically. So please keep telling your friends to check out Missed Apex Podcast so we can keep doing awesome stuff. We are an independent podcast produced in the Podcasting Shed with the kind permission of our better halves. We aim to bring you a race review before your Monday morning commute. We might be wrong, but we're first. Before we get to the interview, let's introduce your panel for today. It's Matt Two Rumpets. Hello, Matt.
Hey there, Spanners. Did you just call our audience tools?
Useful tools. That's the greatest compliment. Hey, a spanner is a tool.
Yes, and nothing personal. I don't want you to take this the wrong way, but I may have already listened to the interview and made a list of questions you should have asked.
Oh, do you know what? I will be absolutely fascinated to hear that, because you get into that kind of situation. I instantly realized that we didn't really typically belong there. And part of me was like a bit apologetic. Oops, sorry, sir. Yes, sir. I wiped my shoes on the way in. I tried to be polite, but I would love to hear how you would have done it differently, all American and that.
Fair enough. I'll shoot you the document later.
We've also got our resident vet, Chris Catman Turner. How's it going, Chris?
Yeah, good evening. Going very well, thank you.
I know you best. I best know you from being the commentator for our Missed Apex iRacing series, where we treat our pretend race cars very seriously indeed, as we did on round one on Friday night, a very successful event.
It was fantastic. And I'm absolutely honored to be part of the Chris Squared commentary team.
Yeah, you and Chris Stevens absolutely knocking it out of the park. And we're joined from all the way in Australia by our video editor, Steve Amy, the person who builds these sets and inspires us to make our broadcasts a little bit more than just speaking and smiling, but making it into an actual TV type thing. Hey, Steve.
Hey, Spanners. How are you? Good to see you again. It's been a while.
Yeah, it's been a while. Two things. Firstly, I do want people to go and check out the link to the iRacing broadcast because it brings up some interesting parallels. You know, when we look at the F1 production and you go, oh, this build up, it's crazy. You know, they're talking to people, they're doing features. But you've done that for us on our kind of, it's not just let's look at the practice and then go into the race. There was features, voiceovers, produced guides and everything. It was amazing.
Yeah, well, thank you. I mean, we try hard to give people something to look at, you know, before the race starts. We don't have quite the resources that the Sky and F1 have, but yeah. We do the best we can with what we've got.
We've got heart, mate. That's what we've got. We've got heart.
That's it.
Yeah.
And we've got a good crew too, so, you know, they all contribute.
And really exciting, I'd imagine, as an Australian Formula One fan. We'll talk about the whole 2022 calendar, but it looks like we're going back to us.
That'd be really good. I think if they don't go back next year, that could be the end of it. So I really hope that it happens. I think it will this time.
Quickie on this. It's not the opening round this year for the first time in a long time. How does that feel?
I'm kind of two minds about it. In one way, I think it's good because Melbourne, I don't think, was ever a good race or a good track for the first race of the year. But it takes away from some of the associated spectacle that goes with the first race of the year. And, you know, it's a bit more important and there's a carnival atmosphere. I hope that, and Melbourne has always had a great carnival atmosphere attached to the race. And I hope that that keeps going a little bit later in the year. And, of course, the other thing is, in the past, it was run before our Australian rules football season got underway, and that has huge audiences. And I'm just hoping that the fact that the football season is already rolling doesn't, you know, take away from viewer numbers and all that sort of stuff.
Why did you not simply outbid the Bahrainis to get the...
I think it's a matter of timing. I think Formula One wanted to leave as much time as they possibly could before the Australian race, just in case we had another flare-up and all that sort of stuff.
Roger that. And also, isn't it the seasons as well? Like, wouldn't you risk rain if we did it earlier?
Oh, well, it's already getting a little bit, you know, it'll be colder, the track temperatures will be down, there is a higher possibility of rain. So all of those things play a part.
Rain isn't a bad thing, but credit where credit is due. I'm pretty sure Liberty will be all over the AFL connection, and you'll see all sorts of AFL players wandering around the paddock that weekend.
Excellent. That's your panel. Steve Amy, Chris Catman Turner, and Matt Two Rumpets. I am going to now play you, though, an interview. I was very excited, and I'm sure there's things I could have done better, and Matt will tell me everything that we could have done a little bit better, but let's take you deep into the heart of Formula One. Have you ever seen your favourite driver bog down at the start and start disappearing down the back of the grid and you think, why F1 gods, why have you abandoned me as a fan and my driver? Was it the driver's fault? Who knows? Was it the car? It's a mystery. Maybe the engineer told them to press the wrong button. It remains a dark, mysterious black box that we are left to ponder. And then maybe someone in the commentary will put us out of our misery sometime later. But F1 is a kind ruler and is providing us fans with new analytical graphics to help unpick all the mysteries of an F1 Grand Prix launch. Here to explain what F1 are up to is the Director of Data Systems at Formula One and, of course, the former F1 engineer at Jordan, Ferrari and Williams. Rob Smedley is joining us in the shed. Good afternoon, Rob.
Hi, Spanners. Nice to meet you.
Now, Rob, you're probably the most famous F1 engineer in F1 history, and us fans really do now enjoy seeing those relationships and seeing how you connected with Felipe Massa. You kind of opened that world up to all of us.
Possibly, yeah. I don't know whether it was an accolade that I was ever interested in or chased after to become the most famous race engineer in F1 history. But if that has resulted in more fans coming to Formula One and more fans enjoying that, the engineer-driver relationship, you know, that sports, technical, psychological relationship, then I think it's a good thing. Thank you.
To be that role, to have that kind of TV-facing role, is it considered like a glamour, aspirational thing on the ladder? Are there people always nipping at your heels wanting to be the race engineer?
No, I don't think so. I think it's very, very hard work. You are in the spotlight and under scrutiny an awful lot of the time. You know, and I think that there's lots of people. There's probably lots of people in the team that would like to do that job, but would never put themselves forward because of the pressure and the amount of time that you need to give up. But there's also a lot of people in the team that would never be interested in that job. So you know, they kind of look at it and they make what I would now consider to be the right decision, that they wouldn't touch it with a barge pole. It's a lot of hard work and a lot of lows. There's some really good highs as well. I mean, I loved it when I did it.
Where is it on the pecking order? Because as far as we're concerned, you know, it's a two-man team that we see on the telly, the driver and the race engineer. Where do you actually kind of sit? Give us an idea of your hierarchy.
Well, I mean, the race engineer, he's in charge of the car, right? So that's where his or her, hopefully soon in Formula One, that's where their remit, you know, is that they are in charge of all the aspects of the car. So whether it's the reliability of the car, whether or not it's the performance of the car, the race strategy, that type of thing. Usually the race engineer, depending on how the team positions the race engineer, but they have responsibility for all those different aspects. They have responsibility for bringing it all together and then for producing what is the best trade-off, the best compromise, which is effectively the most optimized position, be that for the car, for the race strategy, for anything else that's going on. I mean, Formula One has changed so much since I got involved. You know, when I got involved, there was, as a race engineer, there was myself and what we would call a data engineer back then. You know, a guy that would back you up with all the data analytics, which is where I actually started in the first place. And now the teams have significantly more engineers. You know, they have orders of magnitude more engineers, but they also have many more engineers that work on the car, and whether that they're engineers that work on the car at the track, or whether they're engineers that work on the car remotely, you know, you can have engineers, at least one engineer, and more in some cases a lead engineer, and then support engineers for each and every area of the car, and all of these ladder up into the race engineer to allow them to do their job properly.
So it's still a pretty lofty position, but we do wonder, for example, Bono talking to Lewis, how often is it Bono making a call, a snap decision, and he goes, right, this is all on me, guys, I got this? Or does he have someone tapping his shoulder going, you'd best get him to pit now?
Yeah, I think, I mean, if you look there, you know, in that particular organisation, and each organisation is different, so it's very, very difficult to say, but, you know, James Vowles is the guy who runs the actual strategic, the race strategy element of it, and he actually has final say as to when, you know, when the cars pit, you know, when the cars go out in qualifying, all of that, and it's different from team to team. You know, some teams the engineers have a much more authoritative position, kind of like when I was doing it, which was a long time ago now.
So you were in charge then, back in your day. You were a bit more of the main guy.
Well, in my day, the race engineer was a lot more in charge. Now the race engineer has become a little bit more the conduit between, a very, very important conduit, by the way, between the rest of these guys and the driver. You know, and that's the bit that I think has probably changed. That's the seismic change for me over the last, 10, 15 years or whatever.
It's fascinating, and I obviously we want to get into those relationships more, but they don't seem quite as open as you were back in the day, and it really seemed like you and Felipe Massa were proper good mates, and that's why whenever you had to deliver bad news, it seemed all that bit more devastating because we could see the emotion and the connection. But these days, you're away from the pit wall, you're working for Formula One. I mentioned at the top of the interview that we're going to be seeing more stark graphics. And I have to say, it is a bit of a black hole. we see the lights go green, and then one car just doesn't get away. And a lot of the time, we just don't know why. So what is it that we're going to see now that we didn't see before?
Well, I mean, we're going to, you know, you're going to start simple, because don't forget, this is the graphic that is supposed to engage fans, rather than, you know, there's only 50 people in the world who, you know, got my experience that can understand it. I think that would be the wrong approach. So, you know, we're starting off to give you in the first inception of these graphics, to give the fan much more insight about the really important bits and break it down macroscopically. So we kind of say, right, what happens in that first period of the start from 0 to 100 kph, and bearing in mind that a Formula One car can accelerate from 0 to 100 kph in 2.3 seconds or somewhere of the like, these cars are accelerating fairly hard, right? The driver's having to get everything right. And there's a lot of not only hand-eye coordination and just general feel through the seat of their pants as to what these cars are doing and reacting as, you know, each and every meter as it moves along. But there's also, you know, the drivers having to position their car on the track, you know, and see where the gaps are, see where the holes are that they're going to try and get into. And if, you know, it's like the old Days of Thunder thing, you know, if you're going for a hole that exists now, it's not going to be there by the time you get there. So they're kind of, you know, doing all of this, they're using their natural intelligence to try to predict where to put the car. So they've got all this going on. And at the same time, you're trying to accelerate a car, you know, way, way beyond probably what, you know, any road car could ever do, or any modern road car would be able to do, with somebody concentrating on that full time. You know, you've then got the little bit before that, which is the reaction time. And I think this is one of the beauties for me, at least, is we get to show the general public how fast these guys can react. You know, when the lights go out, how fast they can react and drop that clutch pedal to the first position. So you're getting to see all of these different elements of the start, and, you know, rather than just being a black hole, as you said, we're starting to unpick it and we're starting to unpack it.
Is there any reluctance from the teams or specifically the drivers? Because now, when they duff the start, we're definitely going to know it was them.
Well, you know it's them anyway. If you just listen, you can hear it, whether they've made a mistake or whether, you know, whatever it is. I mean, usually, you know, these guys are world-class athletes, right? And, you know, I would say 9 times out of 10, when there's a problem with the start, it's because of some control system setting, or it's because there's excessive wheel slip in the position where the car is that the engineers weren't expecting, or something like that. And most of the time, then, it's up to these guys, it's up to the drivers to find their way through that. And that's the kind of the stuff that we can start to analyze now and look at, you know, where they lost time, but where they gained time back, and how they use the clutch, how they use the throttle pedal, you know, all of these really interesting points to get right underneath what really makes a great start.
From a fan point of view, we've got so much more information than we used to have. Obviously, with the predictions, there's a lot of space for that to not pan out. But with stuff like this, actual information, we've never been better informed. Is this the start of us getting more and more information, do you think?
When we went back, you know, when we started this partnership with AWS and we brought in their ML teams, you know, ML Solutions Labs, my particular thought back then was, it reminded me of Formula One 20 years ago when we started to build all of these tools, you know, perhaps a little bit less artificial intelligence based, but still we were building all of these tools that before guys like me were using a notepad and a pen and a calculator, and watching, you know, the old monitors of page one. And from that, we kind of drew all of our information and made a lot of decisions. And then as you fast forward a little bit, you know, to when I've been doing it for a while and we started to build all of these tools, you know, there was, again, you know, I'll put myself in that chair. And a lot of us said, well, how can these tools possibly, support my brilliance, as, you know, with my pen and my calculator and my and my notepad? And of course, you go 2-3 years down the line of using all of these tools and realize that you are, you know, so many levels deeper than you were before, and so much more accurate in your predictions, that you think, well, I couldn't really live without them now, you know. And if you took away the pit walls from and all the analytical tools and everything else from the Formula One teams, I would suggest that they would struggle a lot. And my prediction was the same will happen with fan engagement in that we kind of have to, you know, you can't bombard the fans with data. Equally, you can't tell the story before the story's happened, because it's just going to become, you know, everybody's going to turn off. So it's about jeopardy, and it's about, you know, maintaining that edge of the seat stuff that, that only sport can do for you, because we don't know the final result before the final result. It's not a movie, right? And I think that if we're able to do that with data, or if we were able to do that with data, then we would engage the fans and the fans would start to really appreciate it. And I think that what we hear now is exactly what was predicted, was if we were to start to take away this data, the fans would struggle without it. You know, the fans are starting to rely on it now. So I think that it's been a good thing and it's been a good experiment. We've just got to get the balance right. You know, through a live broadcast, you can't bombard people with data. But equally, outside of the live broadcast, you know, there's some fans that just want more and more and more and more. And we've got to be able to give them that as well.
I enjoyed and started watching F1 in the late 80s and 90s. If I try to go back and watch a Grand Prix from that time now, I find it impossible to follow. The broadcast quality has gone up. But if I may just put you on the spot before you go, now that we're going to get a glimpse into what drivers are doing, who's got the best reaction time, who's doing what, have you got any predictions of drivers that we're suddenly going to go, oh, they're blinking brilliant at starts, they are?
I don't think we're going to be able to tell you anything that you didn't already know, because the good guys are the guys who get to turn one now, and you don't need data to tell you that, right? What data is all about is for us to be able to tell you how they did it. You know, so it's getting under the skin of it and getting a few levels deeper than where we are now. So I think we know who's good at starts. You know, if you watch the top guys and the way they get to the first corner, the guys who always manage to find that hole and nobody else comes into it, you know, whatever that talent is, you know, this is the bit that we're going to tell you. I think that one thing that will surprise a lot of the fans, and I'm not going to start giving numbers because I think that it's just going to be interesting when these numbers start to kind of fall out of these analytics, but reaction time is amazing. For a Formula One driver, it's amazing. And you know, in some cases you're getting close to or beyond what is considered to be humanly possible. So I think that's going to be a nice little surprise for everybody.
I'm looking forward to seeing it. Thank you so much for dropping into the shed, and thank you for your time, Rob Smedley, and from F1, everyone. Just a thrill. Thank you very much for speaking to us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
The data that you saw in that interview was the F1 Insights powered by AWS or Amazon Web Services. For more information, you can go to aws.amazon.com.f1. There is a link in the show notes below. And of course, you can see all those graphics on your F1 broadcasts. So Matt, now that I am over being entirely just starstruck, it was just incredible to pop onto a call and go, wow, that's actual Rob Smedley from the TV. Have to say, like, the dude is just the friendliest guy. He has got such a disarming smile. It's crazy.
Yeah, well, I think that's part of why. I mean, I think that's part of why he sort of achieved the quote-unquote fame that he did.
Yeah.
Is because he came along at just the right time when we were beginning to hear more and more radio broadcasts between team and drivers. But what I love is that he sort of spanned this transformational period in the role of race engineer. But what I really love is that he's just all about the numbers. In fact, one of my favorite memories is him on the grid. I think it was when he was with Williams, with Massa in his last year. And I think Brundle caught up to him on the grid looking fierce and said, oh, what are you most concerned about? Thinking he'd talk about race strategy or this or that or the other. And he just turned to Martin and said, heat soak, and got right back to whatever it was he was doing. I mean, he is a real engineer all the way through, and it's delightful to hear him talking on our show.
I've just been corrected in our live chat. I misspoke slightly. It is aws.amazon.com/F1. That will get you there. But as I said, the link is in the show notes below. I think something that was interesting was him talking about being a data guy at the core. And we tend to think of the race engineers as you know, got this romantic vision from the past of where he's got a smoke hanging out from his mouth, dirty coveralls, you know, spanner in the back of a thing going, hey, you treat this like a hire car. This is sophisticated prototype, you. But actually, a lot of these guys are like they're proper, like, educated engineers.
Yeah, well, I mean, they are data geeks, and that's how they look at the world, and that's how they make sense of it. And the reason Formula One has hired so many of them is because that is the way forward.
And wasn't it interesting, Catman, to see just how that dynamic between engineer and driver has changed over the years? That's kind of news to me, you know, that difference between the role now and the role back when we were romanticizing that Smedley-Massa relationship.
Yeah, and that's part of what made that relationship so beautiful. It was with him and Massa, who was just a cuddly little chap, and they were so close. And when he had to deliver him bad news, you know, it was just like a father talking to his son. It was a beautiful thing. That being said, though, Spenners, I'm not entirely not to want to argue with Rob Smedley, who clearly knows a lot more than I do.
Here we go.
Yeah, but here we go. So, that relationship, I think, is still, you know, he said it's about a conduit. I still think it's incredibly important. I don't think it's a coincidence that in 2016, you know, Lewis and Rosberg, they swapped engineers, some really high up engineers in his garage. And that did, I think, have a contributing factor to bringing around the change in the guard in that season.
Right. And there's also there's a human element to it as well. So obviously we had all the Felipe baby, and you hear Peter Bonington's tone on the radio with Lewis Hamilton is probably the way I would need to be spoken to. And that's the way that people speak to me, actually, when I'm on air, when I've got an in-ear producer as well. It's like, it's okay, Richard, calm down. Everything's going to be fine. We'll talk about it later. Let's just get on and do the job. You know, when I've been like typing in my little chat, like, this is ridiculous. The guests haven't been lined up. And they're like, okay, Richard, it's all right. You can do this. We'll talk about it afterwards. And that's what I would need. And you're right. It is important.
Yeah. And you could also look at maybe Vettel in his last year at Ferrari, when he wasn't, you know, the team's golden boy. He'd lost confidence in them. They'd lost confidence in him. And all of a sudden, his performance dropped right off. And I don't think that's anyway down to the relationship with the engineer. I think that's a big part of it.
Now, we'll circle back to a lot of the stuff, but I want to ask Steve as well, because I feel a little bit bad. He was talking about the race start, you know, where they replay the race start over and over again at the beginning. And I do feel a bit bad because I was sitting there going, ooh, we have slated that so much. But it's an interesting balance between, they're obviously trying to give us more information. And now, you know, you've been doing like our iRacing broadcast and you've made a lot of TV. Like, pacing is important as well, isn't it? And I think that's the reason they put those starts there, was probably a pacing issue.
That's probably true in the past. These days, there is so much action happening in the first three or four laps of a race that I think that they have to just, you know, concentrate on the actual racing for that period. I understand that you know people want to look at replays of the start, but I think that they could wait a few laps. I really do think that, you know, getting halfway through the second lap and then seeing 27 replays of the start from 27 different angles, I think it takes away from the excitement of the race. Show that stuff later, but maybe show it in your two camera angles, yeah, and then show a bit of the live race and then come back and show another camera angle a bit later if that's what you want to do. But don't take the focus away from the actual racing.
Well, whilst I agree, it sort of makes a little bit of sense now why they've been focusing so much on the starts and the driver point of view if they're about to give us all this extra data.
Sure. And I think they've got to be careful, though. There's a balance between, as Rob Smedley alluded to, there is a balance between, you know, enough data and data down here, data up there.
Data.
We'll argue about that. But I think that there is a balance that has to be struck between the amount of information that the viewers see and an overload in it. You know, too much, it takes away from the racing. Not enough, and we get bored.
We are fragile creatures, aren't we? That is the line, Matt, that they are walking is between us, desperate for data and just going, oh, this is rubbish, I'm going home.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think Steve brings up the excellent point that the issue isn't the number of replays we see, because they're telling us the story of how the drivers got to where they are in the first phase of the race. And that's incredibly important and unbelievably complicated. I can't tell you the number of times I've gone back and rewatched the start myself and said, oh, wow, that's how that happened. I had no idea, because you just can't follow that much action at the same time, no matter how good you are at doing that. The issue that I think most people have had is that they've been covering up some of the subsequent action when they went back to it. But one of the things I like about this graphic is it will give us on screen a lot of information that doesn't require taking the entire race we're currently watching off the screen. And I think we'll talk a little bit later about exactly what they're going to give us, and you'll be very impressed and surprised. This is one of my favorite new things.
Catman, then Steve.
Yeah, as long as it's not intrusive, then that's fine. I think at the last race in Turkey, I was infuriated when they were showing Bottas from P1 leading to the first corner, and there was literally nothing to see whilst people were overtaking. It was silly.
Yes, Hamilton and Vettel were scrapping at that point, and we did sort of miss Vettel's defence. But I think, Steve, you'll agree that heat of the moment choice for video switching, I mean, it's not as easy as we're making out from the sofa. And I'm not just being a stooge just because I got to speak to Rob Smedley one time.
No, it's a difficult thing. I mean, the guys who are directing, and it's not just one person, it'll be sort of three directors on the full telecast, they've got to coordinate and they've got to figure out what is the right thing to show at the right time. And the start isn't really important, you know, part of the whole procedure, really. It's the most important part of the whole procedure, perhaps, except for the finish line at the end of the race. I have a question, and I've noticed in the last couple of races, they put up a reaction time graphic. I guess they were running tests, seeing how it went. Now, they put up a reaction time graphic. It was quite small and quite, you know, down in the bottom right-hand corner of the frame. And it didn't excite me. Sure, the reaction time is an important part of the whole thing, but it's not the whole story. Okay, that doesn't... But then, Matt, you pointed out that you will be able to look at the offline data later. Yeah. And from that, I mean, in millisecond increments, they're not only measuring the reaction time, which is good, but they're also measuring the relative positions of the cars to each other in such small, you know, on such a small scale, that later on you will be able to build a really good picture of actually what went on, where the wheel spin happened, who actually didn't take off on a nice straight line, all of those things from the data. I'm actually impressed that they're collecting that amount of data in that short amount of time. My one thought is I hope that they don't try and overcomplicate the display of it. Mm. They've got to keep it simple.
But the overriding feeling I've got as a fan is, and as a content producer is, more things to argue about. We've got so many more things to argue about when someone gets a slightly better start. You know, people go, look at Verstappen. He's nothing but a pretender. Look at him with his poor reaction time. And other people will go, no, his reaction time was actually statistically better, but the grip level was worse on that side of the track. And it must be the car. Isn't that right, Steve? That's the arguments we're going to have.
Oh, you bet. That's exactly. And that the information they give us is only going to throw petrol on that whole, you know, argument fire, I can tell you.
Oh, Matt, it's a shame we don't really do debates and discussions and stuff. We should get into that more.
Because you know it's going to be people being Giovinazzi fans saying, well, look at his reaction compared to Raikkonen.
Exactly. Oh, it's going to be mint, that, isn't it? Catman.
So collecting this data is nothing new, though, because don't everybody remembers the 27 Austrian Grand Prix when Bottas got a lightning start and everybody was saying, oh, he's got a false start. And they were saying that he started moving within 0.2 seconds of the lights going out. And they were saying, you know, Rob was saying about whether they're going to see sort of superhuman reaction times and really big that up. There's got to be an element of anticipation in that, surely.
A very, very familiar of you to call him Rob there. Obviously different for me. Now we're on, I call him Smeddo. You know, Smedders. No, we're not on those terms at all. Steve?
Well, I think Catman was right. Back then, they did have a measure of whether he jumped the gun. But from my understanding of that is it was a simple timing loop sensor in the car that just measured when you started to accelerate and moved across the timing sensor. It wasn't measuring every millisecond the position of every car in relation to every other car and gear changes and all of that stuff that is now going to be included in this new data set.
Oh, my God, you're saying data, data.
Oh, sorry, just, data, data, me. What the hell?
I'm just, can you not acclimatize to your environment? You're in a UK shed. Come on, Stephen. Trumpets. Right.
Yeah, well, this is what really impresses me. And, you know, I've seen plenty of Amazon graphics come in, especially the more predictive ones, for lots of appropriate ridicule and mockery, and fair enough. But then there are also some of the really fact-based ones, like the turn analysis and stuff like that, that I really, really love. And what I love about this one is this is all based on two things, telemetry from the cars and data from the timing loops. And what they do, and the challenge, and this is what I would have loved to have heard Rob talk more about, how they work this out. The challenge is the timing data from the loops is synced to the start lights. So when the lights go out, you have a set fixed reference. But the data from the car, the telemetry from the car, is only synced to the car's internal clock. So those 20 cars are not synced to each other. And so what they're doing is they're taking the timing loop data and cross-referencing it with the individual car telemetry data to create a fixed clock for every vehicle they're analyzing. And that's like some super impressive stuff.
Uh-huh. Catman, say things I'll understand.
You mean they don't, on the grid, just like a James Bond thing, synchronize your watches, folks, and here we go.
Nope.
Not the ECUs, no.
I was going to say, I absolutely loved that Trump has picked up on, you know, the data that they present has to be relatable and understandable because, you know, if the ones that we ridicule are the driver rating system or the tire wear percentages.
Subjective ones.
You have, yeah, exactly. You have no, the predictive ones where you have no idea where they've got their data, how they could possibly come up with saying that Raikkonen is better than Giovinazzi on this corner. Whereas the ones with the overlays, you know, that's real interesting stuff that you can really get into.
Trumpets.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is the thing, like if you're like the predictive, like there's a 76% chance of an overtake. Well, if I'm looking at a timing screen and I watch a lap or two go by and I see the gap, then I can calculate on my own in my head how many more laps it'll be before driver A catches driver B. And I think sometimes they overcomplicate those kinds of analyses. Mm. But stuff like this, and I love it because really, he's written a whole blog about how this works, and I can highly recommend you go read it for yourself. The link, as you said earlier, will be in the show notes to that blog. But they've divided the startup into the reaction phase, the initial phase, and the secondary phase. And the way they look at it by dividing it up into those phases is the reaction phase really, it's just about who drops the clutch closest to when the lights go out.
Mm.
And who gets the wheel, who gets the clutch bite point right amongst the engineers. The first phase to 100 kilometers an hour is all about who can manage the wheel spin and synchronize the throttle and clutch the best. And then the secondary phase up to 200, this is really what I love, is who uses the least amount of directional change, who gets the best toe, who's made the best positioning and the best guesses aiming at the holes that aren't even going to be there yet to gain the most places. And if that's not enough for you, later offline, they give you a full-fledged analysis of everyone's start with who's on full throttle, when they brake, whether or not they're in a toe. So they give a sample one from Monza. And you can go and look at, this is in the blog, you can go and look at the blog and see how it broke down at the start for yourself and who you think really did the best job.
Okay, so we can't shy away from a lot of ground to cover here. This really is a fascinating topic. Can't shy away from that we have criticized some of those on-screen graphics. And some of them, the one of the questions I would have wanted to ask, but we didn't have time, was how much of it is automatic and how much of it is Mandronic. So as I alluded to, the ones that are predictive have the most opportunity to go wrong. So putting together the microsector times in FP3 to predict the qualifying, there's a lot of room for that to go wrong. And I think that one is purely just from, say, the fastest sectors. And it's probably that they go into the microsectors, not just sector 1, 2, 3. They probably go into there's like 20 timing loops or whatever.
25,
exactly. So that's probably, you know, a bit of information that they have in their pockets that we don't see that gives them that graphic. Other things, like the overtake difficulty, I think there is probably a bit of a Mandronic element there. And then that leaves you open to being wrong, obviously. And then the tire one, I won't shy away from the fact that the tire one seems random. Like it's always, it seems like it's trying to big up. These tires are about to die. Something could happen any minute now. Don't make tea. Don't you dare leave your screen.
Yeah, the best tire thing they ever had was the FLIR cameras. And I wish they'd just bring them back so you could see which tires were getting how hot when.
Yeah, okay. So I'm not going to shy away from that, Catman. That's the only point I wanted to make, is that I didn't want to shy away from the criticism we've had of those kind of predictive ones. But just giving us raw data and things like this kind of gives us the ability to judge what their drivers are doing. And now we can really ask and assess the question as fans, what makes a good start? Like, well, I don't know. I don't have any idea. I've started a single-seater car once, and it was, I watched like a bunch of like, this is all like dads or whatever. Do you know what I mean? I watched a bunch of people in front of me just going ka-dunk and dying, and like hearing the instructor shout, no, all the revs, like literally all the revs, and just drop the turnip and just get out of there. And then so I was like the fifth and I was able to actually get away. But I don't know. You don't know. We don't know. What makes a good start?
I have no idea. But what it'll be really interesting to see is when it's on a wet track, for example, that'll be where you get the most interesting information. You'll see the, as you say, the different phases of the start where they bog down or whatever. I think that's going to be where it's going to be most fascinating.
So do you really want to ask the question, what's involved in the start? Because, you know, I might want to try and answer it.
All right. Okay. Let's give it a go.
All right. So for the reaction, like I said, mainly what you're measuring there is how quickly the first clutch, because Formula One uses two clutches. It's a first clutch and a second clutch. It's how quickly the first clutch gets engaged, which also includes how well the bite point for that clutch is set, i.e. when they drop it, you get maximum traction and minimum wheel spin. So if you get that wrong, you're going to be slower in that initial phase. The first phase is 0 to 100. And there, that's when you start to release that second clutch.
Yeah.
But you're also managing the throttle with that, and you're having to synchronize it. And you're also sensing, am I picking up wheel spin? How quickly am I letting that second clutch out while I'm on the throttle? And then the second phase is, once you're through that, that's all about positioning and slipstream and just correctly maneuvering to the first braking zone.
All right. Well, I think we've covered that pretty comprehensively. I would love your feedback. Do me a favor. Can you do it at feedback@missedapex.net for a little while? I have a big backlog of emails. If you do feedback@missedapex.net, Matt gets it as well. You can also email matt@missedapex.net, or you can DM us to @missedapexf1 on Twitter, because then some of the more competent social media people in the team pick that up, and you might have better luck getting a response if you do that. I think let's wait for some response from this, Matt. Let's sit on it, and I think let's move on with the show. 44 minutes in, and I must say, very, very exciting to have Rob Smedley come and talk to us in the shed, even if he really didn't expect to be doing that. But credit to him for going with it, and I think we got a stonking interview out of it. We could go and talk about calendar stuff, but I have one thing that I want to talk about. I want to talk about practice time. And I know people don't like it when we relate stuff to our iRacing events, but I will loop it in. I think this will be significant. You should check out the link to our iRacing event that Uncle Steve so caringly and beautifully put together. It's like a proper telly program. Go and check out the link below. You'll hear Chris and Chris commentating as well. A great intro from Matt Trumpets at the beginning too. I did the track guide, so that was good. And we had some stewarding from Bradley Philpott too. So you get to see the whole crew in action. Me, Matt, Kyle and Alex were also on track competitors. And now we've established I am the best sim racing driver in the Missed Apex panel, because I'm ranked sixth after round one out of 44 drivers. And here's my question, Matt. It's a bit of a tragedy that I'm up in sixth. I'm not the sixth best driver. but I had quite a lot of time during the day, the daytimes, and I probably did about 1,000 laps, and I was able to just practice my way to the front of the grid.
I see. 1,000-lap Larry.
1,000-lap Larry, as Kyle puts it. So here's the question when it comes to F1 is, obviously, the more practice time you have, the more you can get honed in. We're seeing less practice time with the sprint races. And if a driver like me can compete in the sort of field we've got by just cheating, essentially, it took me that whole time to just even find the best way around the track. And I know F1 drivers are slightly better than me, but the gaps close the more you have practice. And it's not just the drivers, it's the team as well with the setups. So what do we want? Who do we throw that to? Let's throw that to Uncle Steve. Uncle Steve, what do we want on an F1 weekend? If we could give them more practice, would we, to see what their ultimate capable performance is? Or do we want to throw them in at the deep end and see what happens?
I think that it's probably better to throw them in a bit more at the deep end on a race weekend. I think that having less practice puts a little more pressure onto the teams. They've got to perform faster, better. They've got to think on their feet. I think that we could compensate a little for that for allowing a little bit more testing during the year, just so that they could, you know, come closer to grips with the car's performance and that sort of thing. There is almost no testing at all during the year now. And I remember back from, you know, for many, many, many years, some of the big teams ran totally independent testing teams, and they were out testing 5 and 6 days a week. Now, I'm not suggesting we go back to that, but I am suggesting that perhaps we could run 2 or 3 testing sessions during the year, short ones, to give the teams a little bit of extra testing time, and then, you know, keep the testing times short on the week on the race weekends. I have no problem with that.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
We don't have many of the team members that listen to this show, but I can feel them all screaming, 23 races, Uncle Steve! They say 23 races, and you want us to do extra testing time as well. Catman.
Yeah, I know.
Catman.
Yeah, and it's not only, don't forget, that the teams that could do all of that testing were Ferrari in the noughties. You know, you're essentially advocating for another Schumacher dominance era, because you're just going to elevate that gap for those who can do all that testing and those who can't.
So I think it's about core ability, Matt. So look, my baseline general driving talent isn't good compared to the rest of the field, but with practice, with more practice, I was able to bring myself up to that point. So what do we want to test? Do we want to test their ability to master a track as a team and a driver combo, or do we want to test the core goodness of the car and the core driver ability? After my experience this weekend, I feel like I just want to say, make qualifying the first practice. On you go, figure it out. Let them change more. Change Parc Fermé rules by all means, but just let them crack on from quali onwards, and let's see who's got that core skill.
Yeah, well, I love that people absolutely slate everything about the sprint race. But for me, the highlight is the fact that you get a Friday morning practice and then it's right into qualifying. Nobody likes this. I mean, we just heard from Rob Smedley. What is he, a data guy? What does he want? Data. The more practice, the more data. The more tests, the more data. The more data, the more consistent the performance, the less random variability that makes it fun for us to watch occurs. And I do agree to a certain extent. I think it is a test of a driver's talent, not their overall ability to achieve, but it is a test of a driver's talent to be able to walk in and immediately be on it. And I've heard team principals talk about this. There are some drivers who will sit in the car three laps into their first session. They are incredibly fast. Other drivers will take much longer to get there. But the thing is, they all get there. And also, frankly, with the use of simulators, I think it's much less of an issue than it would have been years and years ago, where I couldn't sit on my home computer and learn a track well enough to then sit in the car and go fast on Friday. This is not the same kind of safety issue you might have had earlier.
Catman, answer this from Maria in our Slack chat group. Isn't the whole point of finding out the best of all the teams when they have maximized their abilities? Isn't that the whole point?
Yes, I suppose it is. But then you can also look at it as who can maximize their budget. So, Mercedes have got, $400 million or whatever it is, and Williams have only got 100. So there's no way you're going to get the same performance out of them if they're allowed to extensively test. So you got to limit it somehow to keep the field together. In the 90s and noughties, we had, testing, every single minute. Ferrari had their own test track at Fiorano, and they just pounded laps into the early evenings. You see pictures of them in the dark doing it. And they were miles ahead for that very reason.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you about that. But what I was suggesting was not that we went back to the days where, teams just ran their own test sessions. I'm suggesting that perhaps in the middle of the summer break, there is one weekend where there is testing that everybody can go to. It's 2 days. We'll open up Silverstone. You can come test all you like there. I'm not suggesting that we give teams open slather to test, because there is going to be the spending cap next year. All that has to be taken into account. But I do think that sometimes teams are expected to, they get paid for it, but to perform without really getting a chance to test the real car. Yes, they can go, sim racing in their simulators, but putting a car on track is a totally different ball game, I reckon.
Yeah, as long as it's at Silverstone where I can go and watch it and it's open, then it's absolutely fine.
Yeah, it's only 50 minutes from me, Matt. Jealous much.
Interestingly, Chris Fonseca in the chat room says, let teams with fewer points test for longer. Well, aside from the economic problems with that, because usually teams with fewer points have less money to go testing with in the first place, it's actually already a feature of the rules that teams with fewer points are getting to use more resources developing their car, and teams who are higher in the championship are having more and more restricted computer testing times, wind tunnel times, even engine dyno bench times are being restricted now to help save money. And so I think the economics is what you come up against when you make this argument for increasing testing more than anything else. But also what you're looking at is a team like Mercedes has a huge advantage when they show up to a track. They've got more people, they've got more collected historical data that they can call on. But the shorter the time period the car is actually on track, the more the advantage allies to someone like, say, McLaren, who don't quite have that same budget, but have perhaps an easier car to set up and understand it better. It's not as tricky to set up to optimize it. So I think in the long run, shortening practice time will play to the advantage of the midfield teams. And I think what we're just seeing right now is the sort of the long-built historical advantage of all that money is still playing out a little bit. But the longer it goes with shorter practice periods, the more cars will be designed. And I think it will help even up the field and make the competition more interesting as a result.
So you've spoken for quite a long time there. You've made a lot of points. I will say, I think you've been particularly excellent on this episode so far.
Well, I won't let it happen again. Don't worry.
Yeah, please. You are eclipsing me at the moment. I'm quite upset. I am quite upset. No, good job. Good job. I just I don't know how you do all that without breathing, frankly. I want to take a quick poll then. What I asked, I know Steve brought us down the non-race testing, which is valid. So we're going to vote. In race, do we want a bunch of testing? Like a bunch of practice, FP1, FP2, FP3, FP17? Because we could do, you could just say start Monday. Or would we like to throw them in with, you know, more of the sprint race format that we've seen with less testing, perhaps even leaning towards my just chuck him in at quali? Out of those options, Steve, what do you fancy?
I think shortening the race weekend testings. I think, okay, you know, ideally, I reckon you get one-hour test session on Friday morning and you go qualify.
Nice. Come on.
Problem is that the people who have paid millions of pounds to go and watch your race don't get to see much on-track action. So I'm advocating quali early on Friday. As Spanner said, wonderful idea of opening up the Parc Fermé rules so that if they stuff it in qualifying and get the wrong setup, they can always change it. And then a couple of sessions until the race. Perfect. And no sprint race.
Matt, where do you sit?
I'm firmly in favor of limiting the practice and increasing the meaningful sessions. So count me in for the sprint race. I know it has problems.
Yep. Yeah.
I know it has issues and it should not set the grid for Sunday. I'm fully on board with that. But if it was made its own thing, if it was its own competition that happened on Saturdays, and then you were allowed to make changes for the Sunday, yeah, I think that's the way to go because it's the least practice and the most racing we're going to see.
It's not an entirely unfair point, is it, Catman? Because, okay, we are in danger of throwing the baby out with the bathwater and letting the perfect be the enemy of the good. So, yes, I don't like the fact that it sets the grid because then how do you set the grid for that? You know, it's sprint races all the way down. But that doesn't mean that meaningful sessions throughout a race weekend is necessarily a terrible idea. I don't agree with how it was implemented. But yeah, I don't know. Now I'm all over the place. I don't know what I think.
Yeah, and I love the sprint race as long as it doesn't decide who gets that pole trophy.
Yeah, I think so.
I think it's a ridiculous idea. The guy who gets pole should be the man who is fastest in qualifying. Yeah, you know, they had Lewis was fastest and Bottas had pole. You're like, well, that's
It doesn't make any sense.
How it works.
Yeah.
And I will just point out as a little appendix to this discussion that prior to his entry to Formula One, my understanding was that Lance Stroll hired a historic Williams.
Yeah.
Went to many different racetracks.
Yeah, with Davison. Yeah.
And spent weekends being coached before he even started. So that would be my argument against, you know, everyone coming into the sport should have the same amount of time to get good at it.
Well, now hang on a minute. What was David Beckham's biggest strength? Was that he would spend more time practicing. He was there first and he was there last and he would just kick 1,000 free kicks until he became the best free kick taker of his era. Come on.
Yeah, that's fine. It's the same with Johnny Wilkinson in the rugby, you know, with the goals, the drop goals that he was doing. But you've got to set a limit so that you have a competition. If it was a case of, you know, everybody could do the same, then that's fine. But unfortunately, that's just not the reality.
Yeah, it cost Beckham time and effort,
true,
but not the same kind of money it costs to hire a Williams, fly it to a circuit, hire a coach, and run the thing for a weekend. Not every driver can do that, and that's the advantage that I would like to see nullified.
Okay, listen in, Matt, look, if you're just going to break every analogy I try to bring up on Missed Apex, I feel like it's going to be difficult.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Like you're just constantly like, I'm like the analogy and you're like, oh, it doesn't work for this reason. And you're ruining it.
Okay. I can break it further for you if you like.
Go on then.
So Mazepin decided to rent himself a Mercedes for a couple of years.
Yeah.
So sorry about that. I rest my case.
Sigh. Let's talk about the calendar. Lots of chat from F1 team members before the calendar was announced. There was some really good tweet threads out there actually about what F1 teamsters actually go through, you know, their day-to-day, their routines, and that being kind of then multiplied many times over by the extended calendar. And I do have complete sympathy for people in jobs like that who decide to also try and do it while having a family. you know, after having kids and suddenly seeing the commitment they have increased massively. It must be very scary, but the FIA has come out with a 23 race calendar, and it does look like that's the way they want to go. Formula One will make more money. It will be more successful if they have more dates on the calendar. They want to be in just about every continent, although they seem to have skipped Antarctica and Africa again, and no Kyle Lama hinted at on the calendar. But otherwise, there's a big Middle East presence on the F1 calendar, more dates in the US, still maintaining the European dates and the Asian dates. And how do you do that without adding more races to the calendar? And this is where we're at, Catman. It's the battle between F1 being a commercial entity. And if they put 23 races on, I will watch 23 races. And I'm not the only one. They know they've got me suckered in. I'm like, yeah, just plug it right into my arm. Yeah, just stick it straight in. I'm fine. I'll watch 23 races. I'll watch 50 if they put it on, even if it's not the best. But they have to put that against the human element as well.
Yep, the real killer is, I would watch one every 5 minutes, but the real killer is going to be the 7 double headers and the 2 triple headers that we've got on the calendar. It's going to be absolutely mad for those guys and girls who are having to travel out to the circuits.
Yeah, and Steve, Nick has just put in the live chat, my wife and kids aren't looking forward to more races. Yeah, that's a good point. It's a good point.
I don't blame him.
Yeah, I do. Like, Dad has a bit of immunity in our house during a race weekend. There's a bit, I've been watching it long enough now that people understand, like, you can sit next to me. You cannot chew sat next to me. I have my own headphones for when they're getting too much. I put over the head headphones over the top. You're not going to be sat playing a Rubik's Cube next to me, tree face. Like, there's like a ring of fear around that. It's the only time, in fact, in my house where I have any kind of respect at all, Catman, where they will give me any room at all. But for the F1, yeah, they might not tolerate 23, Catman.
You just haven't indoctrinated your kids enough yet. You know, my little daughter is only 2 to 3 years old. She points at the screen and just goes, go Lando. She doesn't know what it is. She just shouts at the screen.
Steve.
I think that Formula One got to be a little bit careful. Yes, fans like you and I and the people in the chat room,
obsessive nerds, we'll
watch.
Yeah,
you know, we'll watch 100 if there's 100 because yeah. we're tragics. But Formula One, in order to build their audience, have to go after the people that perhaps won't commit that amount of time. And I think you've got to be careful that you don't end up with so many races that suddenly it becomes everyday boring hoo-ha.
Ordinary, I mean,
the old adage is you always leave the audience wanting a bit more. And I think that you've got to be a bit careful about that.
I don't disagree. But by the same token, the more races, the more likely a non-viewer becomes a converted viewer because it's more available for them to casually run across. So I agree. There is a fine line there.
Yeah, they become a casual viewer until it gets to the point where they say, God, there's so many races. I can't afford all this time anymore. You know, my wife is giving me a hard time for spending every Sunday afternoon. Yes,
and husbands also, obviously.
And husbands. And so they drift away and they lose some interest. I think there's you've just got to take all those things into account. And it's not just the fact for the teams, it's hard. Yeah, all these double headers and the triple headers. And it's amazing. I mean, we've got 8 races in 10 weeks at the first half of the calendar, and then 10 races in 12 weeks in the second half of the calendar. And what makes it even worse is not just the number of races, but the way they're laid out. We start the Middle East, we go to Australia for one, go to Europe for one, go to North America for one, go back to Europe for two, then we go to Baku. Is that Europe or Asia?
Yes.
then we go to North America for one, Europe for 7, Russia for 1, Asia for 2, North America for 2, South America for 1, and the Middle East again, where we started, at the end of the season. We've gone around the world 3 times. Surely for an organization that is, concerned about its carbon footprint and all that sort of thing, that is just nuts.
That's it. The one that stands out for me is the Azerbaijan to Canada doubleheader. You know, most of the others, if there's a gap, it's because they're having to cross continents. Whereas, that one is the 12th of June to the 19th of June, going from Baku to Montreal. That's crazy to me.
And not the first time, if I'm not mistaken. I think they've done that weird transfer before, and I don't think anybody likes it. But with your permission, I've had a thought about this. And that is that an acquaintance of mine in a separate industry has come across an issue where they were hired to do a job, short-term job, beginning and fixed end. But the company that hired them said, we demand diversity. There's a huge push for diversity in this industry right now. And they said, well, okay, that's fine. But instead of hiring the two very experienced people I would have hired, because the stepladder to this job is not yet fulfilled, I'm going to have to hire more inexperienced people for longer, and that will cost you more money. But the flip side is I will train them, and then they will be there in this industry for the long term. So I'm wondering, maybe because we're talking about the team's mental health, right? We're talking about stress. Maybe there's an opportunity for Formula One to make a carve out in the cost cap for just for non-majority hires and bring in some people, train them up to help relieve the stress, but not let the teams get away with getting rid of other people just to save money and spend it in the budget elsewhere. I mean, it was just a thought that I'd had.
Yeah.
And I thought it would be worth a little bit of discussion.
So there's a few different cogs there in that argument. And I will say, I'm going to use the word cog twice in two sentences. Damn, this is bad hosting. Okay, but
I'm just doing it to you
today. I am a very small cog in part of that movement to increase diversity that has come out in the last few years, a very positive push. There's some really good people doing some very good things. And one of the things that, you know, the common argument is, well, hire the best people for the job. And if you go outside of that sphere, if you go outside to do positive discrimination, then you'll reduce the quality. And actually, the people I've been helping on a very small scale do that, what they found is actually the quality people, they were there the whole time. Like, it hasn't been that hard. It hasn't been that hard to fill that position with more diversity because there are skilled people out there in the world. It's a myth that somehow the status quo is already filled with all the most talented people and the only people who would be capable of that job. That myth is about to get smashed wide open. So I think we're going to see a lot of positive things from that coming forward. Catman.
Yeah, and I think the Hamilton Commission is really hopefully going to bring some fruit in Formula One specifically for that. And also they're doing it outside with teaching roles in Great Britain to try and help to improve representation of different groups in that specifically.
So you only need to look at what F1 broadcasts themselves have been putting out. Those people, they didn't come from nowhere. They're not like schmucks. That were taught in a very small amount of time to do stuff. There was talented content creators and presenters and broadcasters out there the whole time. It's not that it's easy. It's that you just need the will and you need to look. The more interesting thing that we're talking about right now, I think, is that effect on the mental health of the teams. And you would think that with more races, there would simply be more. But I know there's the budget cap, but if you go from 19 to 23 races, like obviously the budget cap then goes up. Surely. That's got to be right? So instead of having the same people going to every race, then you're going to rotate that a little bit. And you're going to have, okay, I don't know, this is my experience in the military when it came to increased tours. Yeah, we understood. Like me at 22, young, dumb, and full of a lack of responsibility, I'll go wherever. I'll go sit in a forest in Germany, I don't mind. But some of the lads that had families, you might give them slightly less if they wanted to. Or, I don't know. Maybe more if they wanted to get away. But you manage that and there is an element of choice to it. I would feel bad if people were like, you will spend more time away from your family. You will go to 23 races regardless of what you want. But you would hope that with more budget cap, man, that there would be flexibility. And it's actually a good opportunity to normalize flexible working, which in turn helps diversity and inequality, especially helps women. So maybe this is an opportunity.
So yeah, my two points on that were, with the people who are there in the race teams who started when there were only 16 races, now there's 23. They in effect are being forced to because they didn't sign up for 23 weekends away from their partners and families. The second thing is...
Well, hang on a minute. Well, they don't have to do 23 weekends away. If they're being forced to do 23 weekends away, yes. But surely with an increased calendar, there's more scope to be flexible, rotate, get more people in.
Running a business, you would try and do it on the fewest staff possible because your staff costs will be 50 to 60% of your overheads. So, you know, the other thing as well is, is the cost cap actually confirmed to be going up?
No,
with more
no,
races?
Not at all. No, I was speculating. Steve?
Because I don't think that's actually the case. I think it's the opposite. I think the cost cap has been set and they've gone, oh, by the way, you're going to have to do another three races compared to what you were expecting 2 years ago when we signed up to
them. If that's the case, that's madness. But Steve, then Matt.
Oh, well, Catman just made the point. Yes, I was going to ask whether or not we'd had confirmation that, you know, every time they add a race, that the budget cap will go up. And I think I'm in agreement with everyone else. No, it's not. So, yes, the teams are being forced to do more races with no more resources.
Which gets back to why I suggested maybe a carve-out for race team and support team non-majority hires might be a really elegant solution to speeding up diversity in the sport of Formula One.
That would suggest that that would be cheaper. I don't think that's the case. I think, you know, everybody who's got to this level is going to be, you know, excellently qualified and able to do the job.
Okay. So we've got a bit of feedback here from our live chat. We've got who's here that's saying that you will dilute the squads? Ah, Pete. Hello, Pete. Pete says, ain't that easy to rotate? Oh, he's Northern, I know, Pete. Ain't that easy to rotate, says Pete. Team cohesion. But, you know, that is what people said as well when, you know, the European Cup started and the Champions League started and football teams started having squad rotation and you just adapt to it. And yes, in my previous lives that I was talking about earlier, you did have to rotate those teams, those squads, those platoons per mission, per deployment. It happens. You aren't always going to have Bob, Derek and Lillian all lined up exactly the way, the same every single race.
Look at all the new Mercedes engineers at Red Bull now. It's a part of
that took me a second.
You bring in new people and you train them.
All right, let's
I'm just saying, why not make it easier to increase diversity and give the teams what they're begging for, which is a little extra personnel to manage all these extra races.
Pete there in the chat is protesting that he's not Northern, but he's like from Birmingham or something. I've only got one line. I've got like four accents. So come on, leave me alone. Let's look at the schedule itself. And if you are a member of a team and you either agree or disagree, do feel please do get in touch, spanners or feedback at missedapex.net. I want to look at the actual calendar itself. It is a significant change, Catman. We've got Bahrain as the season opener. And yeah. It's a track I love. It's a track that has delivered more than it hasn't. Sorry, Steve. This is a good opener. This is a good... And I think importantly, we will know more about the teams after Bahrain than we tend to know after Melbourne.
It's a slightly more representative circuit. You know, the dust and the different temperatures do make it slightly... I guess it depends on what you want. You know, do you want it to be like a European circuit? Because it's not like that. But it is a fantastic, you know, circuit for dueling. And that's what we really want in the first race. You want them to be coming out guns blazing. You want it to be a real, you know, blaster of an opener. And unfortunately, sorry, Steve, Melbourne doesn't tend to produce often.
No need to be sorry. I agree with you. I think the track configuration in Melbourne wasn't a good one for the first race. And I guess the fact they're going to be testing in Bahrain also makes it easier, you know, logistically and all that sort of stuff if they run the first race of the season there.
Okay. And then so from that, we have got Jeddah. And I guess we're going to find out about that this season, although some pictures of the track don't look entirely track-like. They look quite construction-y.
Did you just say Jeddah?
Oh, no. Hold on. You tell me the...
Jeddah, I think it is, isn't it?
No.
Is it an Obi-Wan Kenobi track?
I think it can be pronounced both ways, Steve. Steve, I don't appreciate you coming on here. All right? I don't tell you how to video, do I? I don't tell you... No, I do. But I
to
do
be
argue
fair, you were
thing.
Telling
Sorry.
Him how to pronounce data earlier. Oh, so I think it's just payback.
I've been foisted by my own potato here, haven't I? Oh, my goodness. Right, okay. So, tell me how to say it again, Steve.
Jeddah.
What did I say?
Yeah, like cheddar cheese.
Okay, so Jeddah, right, we will get a glimpse of how that will be. And I don't think there's not optimism particularly for this first one, but, you know, they will have then another 6 months to get prepared for race two of next season.
I mean, it's still a beach right now. We've got a few weeks left until the actual race. So we'll see how that goes.
Okay. And then we go to Australia. And that's fine. We can enjoy the Australian Grand Prix then, I think, in a bit of context without the pressure of, like, everyone has waited all winter to see who is the best team. Imola, good? Oh, go on, Matt. What's up?
Yeah, no. I was going to say the nice thing about Australia is the temperatures will be headed towards wintertime temperatures. So we should have some fun tire stuff going on.
Is that right, Steve? You'll have fun tire stuff, yeah. I mean, they say that in Australia, the last weekend in March, in Melbourne anyway particularly, is that's where you throw your shorts away and put your jeans and your sweaters on and things. So it'll be certainly cooler, and there's a much greater chance as they head towards winter of rain. So, they're the things they've got to take into account.
The thing about Brits on holidays, we go to places, say like Greece, and we will go to places and go, oh my goodness, and we'll be straight into shorts, flip-flops, shirtless most of the time, whereas the locals will be there like in jeans and perhaps a suit. So you can't really like talk about clothing with any kind of, we don't have any common ground when it comes to that, Steve.
That's true. And I found the same thing when I moved up to Brisbane. I moved up here and it was 20 degrees and I thought it's beautiful. And I looked around and all the Brisbaneites had jumpers and coats and things on. And I've got to say that in 5 years, I've acclimatized. And now when it gets to 20 degrees, I feel cold.
Well, there you go. And then the rest of the season isn't so controversial, really, I guess. We've got Miami. No idea. Another street circuit. So Imola, I like. I will say that, Matt. Imola's return to the F1 calendar to me has been welcome. I mean, it was helped by a little bit of rain this season. But I think it fits as a proper old school track. If you're going to have Hungaro Ring there, you can certainly have Imola.
Yeah, no, it has produced good racing consistently, whether you blame it on the weather or whether you blame it on something else. It's a good track and it's a challenge for the drivers. I think the drivers really like it.
Oh, Monaco's on there, though. They've sneaked that one back in, haven't they, Chris? Look at that. They've sneaked Monaco back in. No one's talking about it. We're all talking about the poor team people. No one's realised that we've got to go back to Monaco.
Right after Spain.
Yeah, well, that always happens, isn't it? It's always Spain, then Monaco, and people tirelessly talk about how the final sector of Barcelona is representative of Monaco pace.
Yeah, but, I mean, I love the fact that Monaco's on there. As is Monza. The thing is, what you want in a world championship is that you have such a variety of different things. You've got some street circuits, some night races, some races that are great for overtaking, some that aren't. But that produces such a wonderful variety of things. It gets a world champion who's best at everything out at the other end.
Matt, I'm so sorry. I forgot Catman was wrong about this. I completely forgot.
I was going to say props to Catman for continuing pushing on through the enormous array of faces you just made during that answer.
Oh, sorry. Was I being distracting? I did put my face on the live stream. I'm not hiding from it. Remember, my rule is I whinge about Monaco all the way up to the actual Grand Prix, and then I don't whinge about it during the race. I just smugly sit back with an expression of, I told you so.
Yeah, well, I tell you, you know what I'm looking forward to is Montreal being back on the calendar.
Oh my gosh, yes. The only acceptable street circuit. The only one. Steve, you're a fan?
Oh yeah, and it reminds me a lot of Albert Park. I mean, it's, on an island. Albert Park's not an island, but it's a self-contained street track around a park. It's not like racing around, up and down the main street. But I've always loved Montreal. I think it's a beautiful track, and I think it has great racing, and the hairpin is a great corner. I'd love to be sitting there and watching it live.
Yeah, I do have half an eye, Matt. I know we want to get to the Vancouver E-Prix for obvious reasons, and I think we'll include Matthew Carter's Canadian E-Fest link in the show notes again below if you want to go and attend that. But Montreal, that has been one of my sit somewhere near that final chicane has been one of my F1 bucket list type things.
Yes, the wall of champions and everybody else who hits it.
Yeah, it's just the wall of champions. Oh, no, forget that Giovinazzi hit it. No, fine, it is still the wall of champions.
Yeah, so the other thing as well is you've got Abu Dhabi who are making changes to their circuit for the end of this year as well. Now, that sits at the final race again. How do we feel about that being the title deciding round?
Okay, I tell you what, look at the calendar. Let's look at the openers. You've got Bahrain, you've got Saudi Arabia at Jeddah. No, Nope, Jeddah. Steve, stop judging me. And then we've got the final race at Abu Dhabi. You know, these are big ticket places to be in the schedule. And the Middle East events are basically having their pick and they are dominating that F1 calendar. They are owning it. And they might end up literally owning it. And this at least shows that region's commitment to Formula One. We've got Qatar is not on the 2022 calendar due to the World Cup, the Football World Cup, but it is on this year's and it will be on the next 10 years. So that's going to be four Middle East races. And I imagine that Qatar won't be put, you know, on Christmas Day. I'm assuming it will be somewhere prominent as well. And I think, Matt, we can be assured that there is at least a will of that region to quite possibly take over Formula One.
Or at least a pool of money vast enough to continue running it. And there's all sorts of interesting stuff. But I'm just going to pose a question here. I mean, I've always, and especially with Liberty in charge, I'm just wondering, is it just a matter of time till we start to see like regional championships to go along with a world championship?
I reckon that's a really good idea. And I think that if they organize it so that you went to North America and you did it and did all the races in North America and went to Europe and did all the races there, I think it would take a lot of stress off the teams.
Okay. So that would work if we weren't in a franchise football environment. If we were in a privateer kind of environment with 30, 40 teams and pre-qualifying, yeah, you could have Ganassi is just like, yeah, okay, we'll just do the US section. And then you could have like a British team go, okay, we'll just do the European ones and we can fight and contest for that. But this is franchise F1, Steve. There's only a limited amount of teams.
I wasn't getting at the point where ringer teams could come in any of those, you know, continental locations. I'm saying stick with the same teams, but we organize it so that we only go to North America once and we do Canada, Austin, Mexico on one run, and go to Europe, do the one run there, go to the Middle East and do the four races all in one hit there. It's going to firstly help the carbon footprint. Secondly, I think it'll take stress off the teams.
They do that in other championships though. So you have IndyCar, for example, who they say they're going to enter all of the races, but somehow when the ovals come up there, they go, oh, well, do you know what? I think I'll duck out. Same as WEC. It's the LMP1 teams who just enter Spa and Le Mans. And they say, yeah, we're going to enter, but oh, I've lost the budget for Shanghai. What a shame. Never mind. We'll just skip that one. That'll happen the same in Formula One if we make it regional.
Well, my thought on that, aside from the obvious one of reducing the travel issues for the teams, is that take something like the European, where suddenly you have McLaren do really well at races. It simply gives manufacturers more wins they can talk about to sell cars and things, and it makes sponsors happy because there's more chances to win. You might have a driver do really well in the Middle East races and be very high up in the championship, and now I can use that to market my gewgaws and doodads to a naive audience, but also because each mini championship is something to be to raise drama, but you still have the overarching world championship that we all know and love. So it's like you just add more winning without any losing.
So looking at the rest of the calendar to fit in our favorites and to bring in the new tracks, 23 races was the only way to do that. It was the only way. And if you look at the calendar, there's nothing else controversial here. You know, Mexico, Austin. We want Austin. We like Mexico, apart from the stadium. We love Suzuka. Suzuka's just, I mean, it's glorious. It's magical. It's breathtaking. Singapore has its place. I don't love the racing there. It's a slightly worse Monaco, but it has got stuff going for it. Sochi. Sochi? Wait a minute. Oh, is that the last Sochi? That's the last one,
right?
That
is the last Sochi. Oh,
okay. Okay, that's good. Monza, Zandvoort has to be there because of Max Verstappen. And then, of course, Spa, Hungaroring, just clinging on to being able to accommodate modern Formula One cars. The French Grand Prix. Well, I'm not going to defend that. We've got Austria, Silverstone, Montreal. So, look, it is a great calendar. There's hardly any duffers in there, and it's going to be a lot of fun. I do hope that I'm wrong about the ways that surely people will mitigate the strain on individuals within Formula One teams. I hope I'm, you know, I hope that that doesn't translate to them being forced at a whip to do 23 weekends when they don't have to. Hopefully it will, there'll be some common sense. There'll be a bit more of a budget. There'll be flexible working. And please tell us if you think we've got that wrong. And this is a disaster for individuals in F1 teams. Obviously there'll be some FOMO if you've got to miss some. I understand that. But do let us know. Feedback@missedapex.net, spanners@missedapex.net, matt@missedapex.net. You can get hold of us all in that way as well. And Steve, you're not doing social media, are you? Why not? Come on, Steve. I know what you do. You lurk with puppet accounts, but you don't have like a Steve, Uncle Steve account.
Mate, I don't have no puppet accounts. I've got enough angst in my life as it is without having to put up with Twitter and those sorts of things.
Yeah, I'm with you. I hear you. Okay, so don't follow Steve. You have to follow him in real life. You can follow Catman at CatmanF1.
Yep, you can. Mm. I'll drop in there and throw in the occasional bomb and then run away and then come back 2 weeks later and do the same thing. But I would suggest you actually follow Mr. Apex Motorsports on YouTube.
Nice. We will, as I said before, we are going to link to that so you can see the fine work of the Mr. Apex team led by Steve Amy for that broadcast. I know it's pretend race cars, but just check out, if you're a supporter of Mr. Apex, check out what we were able to put on there, because I'm very, very proud of it. So please do go and click the link in the show notes below. Follow Matt at MattPT55. I mean, he's been good this show, but normally I'm the best one. I know not this time round. So you can follow me at Spanners Ready and the show at Miss Apex F1. We have a Facebook group as well. And what we tend to do on these streams is give out an award to the people who've been chatting in our Patreon live stream.
Comment of the week.
So, Steve, you have to pay attention here. Matt's going to give us exactly three nominations and then you're going to pick a winner.
Now, would that be three as in like actually three, or
okay,
this, three as in a metaphorical three?
I just give up, man. Just do what you want to do. I'm going to red light, green light this. Okay. So while I'm not looking, you can creep forward with comments of the week. And then when I turn and look at you, you are risking some Squid Game retribution. How's that?
All right. Sounds good to me. We are going to start with our friend Mark, who says, I've said it in the past, but our favorite podcast hosts are a Tool and a Blueheart.
That's just insulting me. That can't win.
But accurate. Very, very accurate.
How dare you? I resemble that remark. I resent that remark.
Mike Stoner is in, but the best analogy is that a simile is like a metaphor.
Oh, don't radio for me. Who was that?
That would be Mike Stoner.
He's the one that does all the puns, isn't he? Right, okay.
It's possible. Chris Fonseca has been nominated for the following comment, which is not the one I would have picked, but since he was nominated for it, I will read it. Quote, this is not the race you're looking for, the Jedi.
Oh, you guys are so mean. You could easily have let that go. No one would have picked me up for that, surely.
And now for my third one, that would be Maria Kledos.
Okay.
This is a unique map pod. Matt has only said tires once, and the pod does sound deflated for it.
Oh, God. Steve, you're going to pick that one, aren't you, Steve?
Yep. That's it. That's the best one.
Read it again for us then, Matt.
Right, for my friend Maria Kledos, this is a unique map pod. Matt has only said tires once, and the pod does sound deflated for it.
Comment of the week.
Absolutely ridiculous shenanigans from our live chat room there. Thank you very much for joining us at this stage. I think what I would like to do is on Friday do a patron-only live stream. I very much enjoy those. They are very casual. They're not quite like normal shows. So it is worse content for supporting us at patreon.com/missedapex, link in the show notes below. But we do just jump on a live stream. We just see who's available, who's around, have a nice casual chat, usually after FP2. Oh, that might be more difficult, Matt. It's Austin, isn't it? It's the Austin Grand Prix. So it's US timing. So it might be in the evening, Friday evening, UK time.
Yeah, not just that, but also the race.
Oh, the race is late
starts
as well.
At our usual broadcast time.
Ooh, okay. So in the past, we've had a bit of a toss-up as to whether to do it the next day or whether to just do it very late on Sunday. I think my instinct is just to do it late Sunday night. So we might start the stream at 11 p.m. UK time, something like that.
Sounds good.
But it's good because normally Steve is, barely getting through his second morning cider by that time.
So, I've got to say, the later you do it, the better it is for me.
And Matt will be awake as well. And
it'll be slightly more appropriate the amount of whiskey I'm drinking. That's all I'm going to say.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay, good. Well, we'll sort that out. But wherever we see you next, all I'd ask is that you work hard, be kind, and have fun. This was Missed Apex Podcast. Oh, check us out, Matt. Too fancy. For the likes of For F1's Sake podcast, where's their Rob Smedley interview? Eh? Where is it? Phil and Chica and the other one?
Other one. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, just like, I guess.
Your faces with your sly, not that funny references to Missed Apex podcast. Shut up, For F1's Sake.
If we go back to Saudi Arabia the second year, will that be Return of the Jedi?
Oh,
here we go.
And where
knew it was coming.
Oh, God. Oh, no, that's horrible. And I think, like, I knew, like, there's no way that it was called Jedi. Like, there's no way. So why did that come into your head? And that's like pure broadcast fog. And you just go, oh, how do I deal with this? So you've got a few choices. You either double down and insist it is that, and just gaslight and then ignore.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Or any negative feedback, like literally block anyone that dares to correct you. Or the other gaslighting thing is to go, no, I did say that. That's the one I use on the gardening show when it's difficult plant questions and the expert gardener will correct me and go, oh, no, it is Fornica Harry Potius. I go, yeah, no, I said that. And they go, did you? I go, yeah, it is. I don't know why I said Fornica. My God.
That is the best. Oh, did that come on?
Ever. Oh, it's been a rough one, this.
I was just going to suggest you pronounce all your A's as I's from the rest of the show, and then it just seems normal.
Okay, Steve, we're going to have to get the live version
it's just your accent,
taken,
then.
Taken down as quickly as we can.